What's up, you guys? I'm Haley.
And I'm Andrea.
And this is Inhuman, a true crime podcast. Welcome back, everybody. Happy new week. Happy, I can't believe we're literally in the last week of January or last half of January already. Like,
yeah, it's like simultaneously the longest month ever, but it's also like flying by at the same time. It's like a weird,
it's going so fast.
Inception.
But today I have a really crazy story for you guys, and it was suggested by one of our listeners a while ago. So thank you for the suggestion. I had never heard it, and it's pretty wild, and I was literally researching it while in the car with my husband and, like, telling my husband all about it, and then he'd ask me a question, and I'd be like, I don't know, I'm not at that point in my research yet. So it is a crazy story, and yeah, let's just get into it.
Sounds good.
Today, we are going to be talking about a man who murdered his entire family and then started a new life that he lived for nearly 18 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So this is the List Family Murders, aka the murders of Helen, Patricia, Frederick, John, and Alma List.
Okay.
John Emil List was born on September 17th, 1925, to John Frederick and Alma List in Bay City, Michigan. After he graduated from high school in 1943, he enlisted in the United States Army, and so he served as a laboratory technician during World War II. Then he was discharged in 1946, and he began studying business administration at the University of Michigan. So after being discharged from the Army, he was like, I'm going to go get a business degree. So he got a business degree, and then he also got a master's degree in accounting. So he was very smart, well-educated. Yeah. After finishing school, List was commissioned a second lieutenant through ROTC, and then in 1950, he was recalled to active military service to serve in the Korean War.
Okay.
This time, he was stationed at Fort Eustis in Virginia, and there he met a woman named Helen Morris Taylor. So Helen and her daughter, Brenda, were living on base after her husband was killed in action in Korea.
Oh, that's so awful.
So they were still living on base there, and they met John List. And John and Helen became close pretty quickly, and they started dating. And in December 1951, the couple married in Baltimore, Maryland.
Okay.
At this point, List's accounting skills were recognized by the Army, so he was reassigned to the Finance Corps. So Helen, Brenda, and John all together moved to Northern California for him to work there.
It's a big move.
Yeah. He was discharged in 1952, and after that, the family moved to Detroit, Michigan for List to start a new job at an accounting firm. So his time in the Army was done, and he was going to be working as an accountant. You know, his degree had gotten, he had a master's in accounting, so that's what he was going to do. He worked for a year at this accounting firm, and then he got a new job as an audit supervisor at a paper company in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And while in Kalamazoo, John and Helen had three children. So Patricia was born in 1955, then their first son, John Frederick, was born in 1956, and then Frederick, their youngest, was born in 1958. In 1960, when the three List children were 5, 4, and 2, Helen's daughter, Brenda, from her first marriage, moved out and got married. And at around this same time, List got a job at Xerox, the, like, paper company.
Yeah.
And this job was in New York. So the family moved to Rochester, New York. List rose in the ranks at Xerox, and he eventually became director of accounting services.
Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah. And then in 1965, he accepted a job as vice president and comptroller at a bank in Jersey City, New Jersey. And just in case anyone else is wondering, like I was, A comptroller is basically like a management level position, and they're responsible for supervising the quality of accounting and financial reporting for an organization. So this is a pretty like high level position. List was very successful. He had a successful career.
Yeah. It sounds like at that point he was pretty trustworthy, because that seems like something that they would want a trustworthy person to be in that position.
Yeah. I mean, he was good at his job, clearly, because he kept moving up. He had served in the army, and then he had done work at high levels in multiple companies. Like, he was successful. And with that successful career, the family had some money. So they moved into a mansion in Westfield, New Jersey. And if Westfield sounds familiar to you, you may be remembering it from the story of the Watcher House. So that's it's a pretty well-known story now, because in 2022 it was turned into a show on Netflix, and I'll actually talk a bit more about the Netflix show at the end, because there's something else related to this case from the Netflix show. But we also covered the Watcher House back in episode 27, and it's I think one of my favorite cases I've ever covered.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
It is. But just a little bit of background around about Westfield. A lot of people who lived there compared it to the town Mayberry in the Andy Griffith show.
Aww.
Yeah. It's like just like this cute, quaint, idyllic town. And in 1960, the population was just over 31,000. And this was a 19-room mansion, and it was super extravagant. There were marble fireplaces. There was an art gallery and a ballroom.
Wow.
Several of the rooms had like oak paneling, and then the most extravagant part was a Tiffany stained glass skylight.
Oh my gosh, I bet that was stunning.
Yeah. So the family of five lived there, plus John List's mother, Alma, who was in her 80s. And they were, you know, swimming in space in this mansion, but they could afford it.
Yeah.
And they seemed to live a decent life there. They attended church every Sunday, and List taught Sunday school. The kids were popular in school and hardworking, smart kids, and List was a successful accountant. For the next 6 years, List was a hardworking husband and father, providing for his family. At least that's what it seemed like to the outside.
Mm.
On November 9th, 1971, John List would do the unthinkable. He took the kids to school that morning, just like normal, and he returned home from dropping them off, and took out his 9mm semi-automatic handgun and his father's Colt 22 caliber revolver. He approached 47-year-old Helen, his wife of almost 20 years, from behind, and shot her point blank in the back of the head.
What in the world?
He then went up to the attic apartment and shot 84-year-old Alma, his mother,
above
the left eye.
How would you face... Oh, my God. Ugh.
I know. Then, List waited for his children to get home.
No.
When 16-year-old Patricia and 13-year-old Frederick arrived home from school that afternoon, List attacked them from behind, shooting them each in the back of the head.
Oh my God. How old were they?
16 and 13.
Oh my God.
With four out of his five immediate family members dead in the mansion, List made himself some lunch. He ate half a sandwich, and then he went out and drove to the bank that he managed to close out both his and his mother's accounts. Then he headed to Westfield High School to watch 15-year-old John Frederick play in a soccer game.
What in the world? Psychopath.
Yeah. So he watched him play, drove him home, and then once they got back home, he attacked him.
Why? What? Why? I mean, why would you sit there and watch him play knowing that you're going to murder him?
Murder him? I know. Absolutely sick. And John Frederick actually tried to fight back. He was the only one that was able to, like, somewhat see it coming in a sense that, like, he was able to try to fight back. So he suffered several gunshot wounds. And unfortunately, he didn't survive. After killing his entire family, List placed the bodies of Helen, Patricia, Frederick, and John Frederick on sleeping bags in the mansion's ballroom. He left Alma up in her attic apartment, and he would later say that this was because she was too heavy to carry down.
Wow.
List then sat down and wrote a letter to his pastor. So this 5-page letter, which was later found on the desk in his study, detailed how he had seen too much evil in the world and decided to kill his family to save their souls.
Was he having an affair?
No.
Okay.
No, but it was something else. But this is what he claimed.
Wow.
List wrote notes to the children's schools and part-time jobs claiming that they would be gone visiting Helen's grandmother, who he said was sick, in North Carolina for a few weeks. And she actually was sick and had recently canceled a trip to come visit them. And List would later say that had she not canceled that planned visit to Westfield, she would have been his sixth victim.
Oh my gosh.
List also stopped milk, mail, and newspaper deliveries to make it seem like they were going to be out of town and, you know, make sure things weren't piling up on their doorstep.
Right.
And then he prepared the house to look like they had left. He tried to clean up, and he also went around and removed his picture from every single family photograph. This will make sense in a minute.
Okay.
He left all the lights on in the house, and finally, he turned the radio on to play music from a religious radio station. And then he left.
That is so bizarre.
And it took almost a month for anyone to discover what had happened in the List household. So this was in part due to the letters that he sent to the kids' schools, because they weren't concerned that they weren't showing up because they were told they're going on a trip.
But a month had gone by and they're like, it's a long trip.
People started to get suspicious. But this was also because the family was kind of known to be a bit reclusive. They didn't really socialize much, didn't come out much. Helen didn't really, you know, go out into town. So it wasn't super odd. And the neighbors were noticing, you know, there's not activity here, but all the lights were on. So that was really bizarre. But for a while, they just figured maybe they left the lights on when they went out of town.
Yeah.
But slowly, over almost a month of the neighbors sitting there watching the light bulbs burn out one by one, they decided that they were going to call the police. Officers arrived at the List mansion on December 7th, 1971. And after no one answered the door, they entered the home through an unlocked window in the basement. When they entered the house, they heard that organ music piping through. And Westfield Police Detective Bernard Tracy would later say, quote, it was like a funeral type music that was very disturbing to the officers who were there.
Oh, no.
They also noticed a faint, foul smell. And once they made it to the ballroom, they found the horrific scene. Helen, Patricia, John Frederick, and Frederick's decomposing bodies were stacked in the ballroom on top of blood-soaked sleeping bags. There was a blood trail on the floor that indicated that they had been shot in the kitchen and dragged into the ballroom. In the kitchen, there were bags of blood-soaked paper towels and a bloody mop. So they figured that the killer had tried to clean up. But this makes literally no sense, because why would you clean up and then leave all the evidence there? Like, doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't.
In the study, police found the letter that List left along with the two guns. And then in the attic, they found the body of Alma. But John List was nowhere to be found, and he was immediately the prime suspect in the murders. A nationwide manhunt for him began immediately, but police had little luck. And that was why List had taken all of the photos of him out of all of the family photos. This was the 1970s, so there were no digital records of photos. And with all the physical photos gone, police didn't have a good, reliable, recent photograph of him to circulate. The most recent photograph was from a few years before the murders.
I was going to say, like, even the DMV, I bet. I mean, did they even have photos on their
Oh, I have no clue
point?
If they did. But
that would
probably
like
not
only...
because, yeah, because there was no, they didn't have a recent photo.
Wow.
So that just made it that much easier for List to basically hide in plain sight.
That was smart. Very smart.
After the discovery of the bodies, the FBI found the family's 1963 Chevrolet Impala parked at JFK Airport in New York, but there was no evidence that List had actually boarded a flight. So he had clearly planned this out very meticulously. He had, you know, stopped all deliveries, planned things so that they wouldn't be found for a while, parked the car at the airport to make it look like he had fled via plane. He knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
For almost a year after the murders, Bree's Knoll stayed empty. In August 1972, the mansion was actually destroyed by a fire. And the fire was ruled to be arson, but there were no suspects, and it's unclear who burned down the house. I don't think anybody believes it was List. I think it was probably just, like, somebody wanting to set fire to a house, and the house was empty, so that's what they
or
did.
Maybe they knew the story of what happened there, so they were like, get rid of this place.
True. Yeah. And in 1974, there was actually a new property built on top of the land. Yeah, kind of freaked me out when I learned that.
Yeah.
Over the years, there were hundreds of leads, each of which were followed up on diligently, but there was never any success. List remained at large for the next almost 18 years.
That's so wild.
Investigators would later learn that John List had traveled by train from New Jersey to Michigan after the murders. And then he headed to Colorado, where he essentially had no roots or connections. No one knew him there. He changed his name to Robert Peter Clark, going by Bob. And he chose this name because it was the name of one of his former college classmates. But the real Bob Clark would later say he hadn't known List at all. In 1972, List settled in Denver, taking a job at an accounting firm under the name Bob Clark. And he worked there for a few years, and then in 1979, he took a job as the comptroller at a paper box manufacturer outside of Denver. And in Denver, he got involved in the community. He joined a Lutheran church, and he even ran a carpool for church members that didn't have transport.
Why?
Yeah.
It makes so no weird. Sense. Like, you
After
literally
you murdered your
brutally murder your whole family, and now you're going to be this, like, upstanding citizen, like,
Yeah, it makes no sense. And he, I'll go into this more later, but he really, like, thought he was doing what was right by, like, quote unquote, saving their souls.
What about saving his
own
soul?
So he probably thought, yeah, true. He probably thought he was a good person because he saved them, and now he didn't, you know, he was just living his life. And speaking of living his life, in the mid-1980s, at a religious gathering that List attended, he met a woman named Dolores Miller. And the couple ended up dating, and they got married in 1985. Wow. In 1988, they moved from Colorado to Midlothian, Virginia, where List, still using the name Bob Clark, worked as an accountant at a small accounting firm. But this would not last long.
Good.
In May 1989, the story of the still unsolved List family quintuple homicide aired on the show America's Most Wanted, which is crazy because my case, I think last week, was solved thanks to a tip from someone watching that same show.
True, yeah.
But in this episode, there was an age-progressed clay bust of List that was shared.
Ooh.
So this bust was created and sculpted by expert forensic artist Frank Bender with help from forensic sculptor Richard Walter. And the bust was extremely accurate. And I'll post a comparison photo of the bust to an actual picture of List when he was caught, because it's actually kind of scary how accurate it was, especially considering they had such little to go off of what he looked like before the murders.
That's amazing. Just the fact that they could do that. Like, obviously now they have technology that can do that. But to sculpt
yeah.
someone's face that you don't even know what they really, yeah. I mean, you know, like what they looked like, but you don't really know what they look like now. That's amazing. Yeah,
so like not only are you able to sculpt something like based off of a picture, but you're able to age progress it. Like,
yeah,
it was insane. And they theorized what he looked like now. They made his face kind of sag a little bit more yeah. fine lines. They even List had a surgical scar behind his left ear, and Bender literally researched what a scar would look like after all those years yeah. to make sure that that was accurate.
Wow.
And then probably the most important part of this was that Walter theorized that List, who previously wore glasses, mm-hmm. would not have chosen to get contacts, and that he would be wearing a different type of glasses than he was when he was younger. So he theorized he would be wearing horn-rimmed glasses, and that he would do this to make him appear successful, because he basically said List would want to come off as successful, important, so, and those glasses would make him look like that.
Okay.
And he was right. When the episode aired on America's Most Wanted, Fox Network estimated that it was viewed by 22 million people that night. And Damn. One of those people was List's former neighbor.
Oh, I thought you were going to say his wife. I was going to be like, oh my God. No. Okay. His former neighbor.
His former neighbor. And she recognized the suspect as who she knew as Bob Clark. Mm-hmm. And she said that at first when they were describing him, it sounded familiar, you know, a church going man, an accountant. He had a scar behind his left ear. And then when she saw the bust and the glasses, she was like, I know him. Mm-hmm. So she called police to tell them about Bob, and authorities were able to locate him in Virginia.
Wow.
So in May 1989, authorities went to Bob Clark's home, mm-hmm. where his wife, completely clueless of her husband's life before, was absolutely shocked to learn that he was wanted for the murder of his entire family.
Wow. That poor woman.
I know. Can you imagine, like...
No.
Oh,
I mean,
God.
That would be... I would be like... scrub my skin off with a Brillo pad, mm-hmm. first of all. Like, how could I be with someone and not know that they were capable of such monstrosities? Mm-hmm. And then
lied about it, yeah. hid for all these years.
Not terrifying. Even his appropriate, accurate name. Like, that's mm-hmm. just, gosh.
So scary. So finally, John List was arrested at his accounting office. He was extradited back to New Jersey. And for several months, he continued to claim that he was Bob Clark.
Mm-hmm. I mean...
But eventually, he had no choice but to admit his true identity, because police were able to match his fingerprints to a record of a gun purchase from a month before the murders, his military records, and evidence from the crime scene.
Yeah, I was going to say, what about the military? They should have something, like his DNA yeah. or something. So that's
yep.
good.
Fingerprints. So they were able to match. And on February 16th, 1990, John List finally admitted his true identity.
Wow.
He was brought to trial, during which he testified to what had led him to commit the murders. So List claimed that in 1971, he had been laid off due to the closure of the bank that he worked at. And he was humiliated about losing this job, and he didn't want to tell his family. So for months, he continued his like normal work routine. Every day he'd get up, get dressed for work, leave the home, and then he'd either spend the day interviewing for other jobs or just at the train station reading newspapers. And then he'd go back home after work hours. To avoid defaulting on the mortgage on the mansion, he slowly started skimming money from his mother's bank account. And no one, they were none the wiser. They didn't know what he was doing. He was extremely manipulative.
Yeah, and she was probably trusting her son to take care of her, not really worried about her.
She was
funds.
84.
Yeah, she's just living her life.
Yeah. The family's financial situation became more strained as the year went on, so List encouraged his children to get part-time jobs, and he pretended this was to teach them about maturity and responsibility, but really it was so that he could use the money they made to keep up the act that he was still making the normal amount of money. You know, he didn't go get a new job.
Yeah. What the fuck? Like, you have this laundry list of achievements behind you. Mm-hmm. Somebody's going to give you a fucking job. You don't need to kill your whole family, psychopath. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But there was more to it, because on top of the financial difficulties, Liss testified that his wife suffered from alcoholism and untreated syphilis.
Oh.
So she reportedly contracted tertiary syphilis, which is an STD, from her first husband. Mm. But she had reportedly kept this hidden from Liss and from doctors for almost 20 years.
Jeez.
So Liss claimed that Helen had initially pressured him to marry her by claiming she was pregnant when she wasn't. And then she also insisted that they get married in Maryland because Maryland at the time did not require a premarital syphilis test, which many other states at the time did.
Wow. Must Isn't have been that a wild? Problem.
Yeah.
Like, damn. Like, you got to go get a syphilis test. Like,
before you get married. Yeah. Crazy. But Maryland didn't require that. So Liss claims that's why she insisted to get married in Maryland. And Helen, according to Liss, kept her condition a secret. But her health was progressively deteriorating, and it's a pretty serious disease and can lead to some serious health issues. So by the time she told her doctors in 1969, between the illness and her alcoholism, Liss said that she had, quote, transformed into an unkempt paranoid recluse.
Now, did the doctors confirm this, or?
Yeah, she did have syphilis, and it also kind of explains why nobody questioned that she was she wasn't really going out and into town. She wasn't working. She was kind of known to just stay in the house. So when she wasn't seen for a month, it wasn't like people weren't concerned about it.
Yeah.
Finally, according to forensic files, Liss also, quote, feared his family was turning away from a Christian life and would eventually stop going to church. So apparently Patricia was interested in becoming an actress, but Liss considered acting an immoral profession, so he didn't like that.
Okay.
And then he didn't like that his wife was an alcoholic, reportedly, and that she had syphilis. And he didn't want the family to go on welfare and admit that they needed financial help because he lost his job.
Wow.
So because of the state of his financial problems and his family life, he decided to murder them because he wanted to ensure their souls would go to heaven. A court-appointed psychiatrist testified at Liss's trial that he suffered from obsessive-compulsive disorder. And that he, quote, saw only two solutions to his situation, accept welfare or kill his family and send their souls to heaven. And in his eyes, welfare was not an acceptable option because it would expose the family to ridicule and, quote, violate his authoritarian father's teachings regarding the care and protection of family members. So basically what that means is this psychiatrist is saying that John List had this idea in his head from what his father had taught him that he had to care and protect for his family, and he wasn't able to do that. Going on welfare would mean he wasn't properly doing that, so he decided to kill them.
Okay.
But despite the defense's best effort to prove he hadn't been acting sanely, is that a word? Sanely?
Sanely,
hadn't been acting. Yeah. With sanity, I don't know, that he basically hadn't been acting in his right mind.
Yeah.
On April 12th, 1990, 18 years and 5 months after John List killed his family, he was convicted on 5 counts of first-degree murder.
Finally.
While he somewhat admitted to what he'd done, he continued to deny direct responsibility. At his sentencing hearing, List said, quote, I feel that because my mental state at the time, I was unaccountable for what happened. I ask all affected by this for their forgiveness, understanding, and prayer.
No, because you premeditated their murders. You planned this whole life after. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that you are sorry at all.
No. And he would later say, like, basically once he made the decision to do it, he couldn't look back and that he had to do it. And it's like, no, that's not true.
And like to say that stems from his obsessive compulsive disorder, like that doesn't really add up for me. I don't know.
No. No.
Like I understand like compulsions and like that aspect of it, but a compulsion to me is more like in the moment, like you have to do it, whereas he planned it out probably for weeks or months. And yeah.
Thankfully, the judge was having none of it.
Good.
At the hearing, the judge said, quote, John List is without remorse and without honor. After 18 years, 5 months, and 22 days, it is now time for the voices of Helen, Alma, Patricia, Frederick, and John Frederick List to rise from the grave. Mm-hmm. John List was sentenced to 5 life sentences, and he was sent to the New Jersey State Prison in Trenton, New Jersey. He, of course, filed an appeal based on the basis that his judgment had been impaired due to PTSD from his military service. He also argued that his confession letter that he left at the crime scene was a confidential communication with his pastor, so it should have been inadmissible evidence because it was a confession. He wrote what he did. So he's trying to say this should have been inadmissible.
No.
Yeah, no. A federal appeals court rejected his appeals on both accounts.
Good.
In 2002, List did an interview with journalist Connie Chung, and this was the first time he finally publicly expressed some degree of remorse, saying, quote, I've regretted my action and prayed for forgiveness ever since.
Yeah, you better.
When asked why he didn't take his own life, he said, it was because he felt that that would prevent him from going to heaven, and he wanted to ensure he would be reunited with his family in the afterlife.
I mean, fair, I guess.
But you also killed your family.
It literally says in the Bible, thou shall not kill. That means anyone, yourself, whatever. People, no, you just don't kill. Yeah.
So I don't think you're going to heaven anyway, buddy. Mm-mm. In that same interview, he said, quote, I feel when we get to heaven, we won't worry about these earthly things. They'll either have forgiven me or won't realize, you know, what happened. I'm sure that if we recognize each other, that we'll like each other's company, just as we did here when times were better.
It's not their forgiveness you have to worry about, sir. It's the Lord's. And it's I mean, he does forgive people, but I don't think that you're genuine in your guilt.
No. And even if he did, like, believe he was doing this for the best, the fact that he, like, planned it out so meticulously, there was some sense of psychopath in there, at least.
Oh, yeah, for sure. He's giving psychopath vibes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. On March 21st, 2008, 82-year-old John List died from complications from pneumonia. So he spent a long time in jail.
Yeah, I was going to say this. You know, at least he got to serve a lot of time.
Yeah. The story of the List family murders has been portrayed several times in the media throughout the years, including inspiring one of the characters in the 2022 Netflix series, The Watcher. So the character in the show named John Graff, who is played by Joe Mantello, this character was inspired by John List. So he was an accountant who attended a Lutheran church. He killed his family members and live-in mother, and he left music playing in the house when he left after planning an alibi that left their bodies uncovered for weeks.
Wow.
And it's like crazy that it's, you know, John List.
Like a crossover.
This happened in Westfield.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when you look up Westfield, like the Wikipedia page for Westfield mentions both the Broaddus family, the Watcher House story, and John List.
Mm. Don't love that. Especially because it's supposed to be this Andy Griffith Town. It's like, no.
Yeah.
Let's not refer to it as that anymore.
Yeah. But that is the insane story of how John List evaded authorities for 18 years after murdering his entire family. And I mean, even if you take away the fact that he killed them, the fact that he like stopped the deliveries and closed the bank accounts and wrote letters to the school to come up with like a story as to where they were, just mm-hmm. the fact that he thought to go through the house and remove every photograph of him yeah. so that there wouldn't be a photo that could be circulated, just yeah. that in and of itself proves that he knew what he was doing.
Oh, yeah, I 100% agree.
So, yeah, it is a crazy story. Thank you to the person who suggested this case because I had never heard of it. And when I saw, like, when I read, first looked it up and it said, like, evaded authorities for 18 years, I was like, say what?
What? I feel like I've seen him because, like, he's a very creepy looking man.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't think I've heard this case. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a wild story. And I'll post pictures of the bust versus him because, like I said, it is like scary how accurate mm-hmm. it was, especially knowing that like they had very little to go off of.
Yeah,
it's insane. But that's all I have for you guys today. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, keep it human.
Bye guys.